Welcome to Acorn to Oak, a tree podcast rooted in real stories and growing knowledge from soil to canopy. Today's guest has seen forests in ways most of us only watch on documentaries. Jared Oren, ISA certified arborist and co-owner of Bluestone Tree, spent time out west as a hotshot for the National Forest, fighting wildfires on steep, unforgiving terrain. He also worked in logging operations that landed him on the reality show Axemen. We're talking fire lines, falling timber, TV cameras, and how those high-intensity years shaped the arborist he is today. So how are you doing?
You're doing good.
I'm doing great. Yeah. You're doing great as well.
Right. Yeah. I'm practicing that, telling people that they're having a great day as opposed to asking them how their day is.
So if I walked in the room, what would you say to me?
So you look like you're having a great day today.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I know a few people that it might make me enjoy hanging out with them if I started that way, because I feel like they're that honest person that tells you how crappy their day actually is.
Starting with our kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea. I'm going to practice this at a pickup today.
You totally should. Yeah. There's I think in some of the psychology, there's the, when you're feeling dysregulated or whatever, and you're getting out of control, verbally talking to yourself as a third person and using your name, like, mm-hmm. Jared, this isn't real. You need to calm down. You're getting out of that, such as that friend would tell you. It puts your mind into that state of, oh, it actually does. They've done a lot of research on this. And I think that telling someone they have a great day probably works just the same way.
Yeah. I'll report back to you tomorrow how pickup goes, because normally it's a hot mess.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to hear everybody being like, what is Stephanie's problem? She's telling me I'm having a great day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's your fault.
This is going to be a good podcast.
It's going to be a great podcast.
So, if only we could wish our way to everything.
Yeah. So I am excited to talk about this today. I have very little knowledge on it. It all stems back to a work/backpacking trip that I did in the Sawtooth Mountains back in 2001, where I was actually replacing bridges that had been burnt down by a fire the previous year or a couple of years prior. And I got to meet some people who worked for the Forest Department, and some were training to become hotshots. And then, I'm sitting here in a room with someone who was a hotshot. So yes. I'm excited to hear where their adventures went after their training ended. And yeah, they became hotshots.
I am glad to hear you say the word hotshots, because sometimes we are the stepchildren of the Forest Service fire program, where a lot of people, the fame and glory goes to the smoke jumpers.
Yeah.
These are the guys that jump out of...
When I wrote you yesterday and you said, oh, I wasn't a smoke jumper, I was a hotshot. I was like, oh, yeah, never mind. Yeah. No, yeah. Just kidding.
We actually hiked all our gear up the mountain.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't get flown up there with our... with our hammocks and, our Tevas.
Yeah.
So, but they're all great guys. I make fun of them. Yeah. I make fun of people I like. That's just, the nature of how I grew up.
And yeah.
Probably all of us grew up in the 80s. If someone liked you, they made fun of you endlessly.
Yeah. Did most smoke jumpers start out as hotshots?
I would say that's a pretty regular path.
Yeah.
Going forward, sure. Some of them, either jumped ahead or had... maybe another workaround path, but yeah. Whether you're on an engine or whatever, but whether it's the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, or the Forest Service, both of those kind of operate in parallel in the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Let's start with maybe how you got started and where were you located?
Oh, well, we'll go back to me as a small young boy at about 17, 18. I grew up with my two sisters and brother, and then my two sisters actually went into the Forest Service. A lot, mm-hmm. That's a career path for a lot of young kids out west. We're in the Midwest here. So you would do stints of 2 weeks. You'd go get your red card and certified out. And then Indiana would pick a crew. They'd call you up and say, hey, we're going to send a crew out for 2 or 3 weeks. Do you want to go? So my sisters both went out there and experienced it. Now, one of my sisters fell in love with out west. And, mm-hmm. and once she went, she never came back. So she still lives in Montana. And so I had always had hopes and dreams of doing it and thought, I'd love to do it. But I just... jobs and careers never could. Then when I was about 30 years old, I had an opportunity to go out west and thought, you know what, you're only young once and it's a short life. So I decided I'm going to go out there and head for that. I think my intent was to be a smoke jumper. Don't tell them that. You know, I don't want them thinking that I idolized them and changed my whole career path on account of them. So that's originally why I went out west, left my job here and went out there and didn't have a job. Mm-hmm. My sister was out there, so I kind of had a springboard of places to go and was hanging out with her and kind of babysitting my niece. I was looking for a job, got my red card, and then got on a private forestry service called Grayback. They're kind of a private that does fire and also does forestry work. Okay. You know, they'll get large contracts and stuff like that. I would say that that was one of the humbling experiences I had. Many of the jobs I had out there out west was pretty humbling. You know, you work hard out here in Indiana and then you go out west and you're like, oh, work twice as hard for twice as long and twice as less pay. So mm-hmm. that was kind of my observation of what it was like out there. But it was amazing and great. I worked with a lot of young kids. I was the oldest, you know, except for the supervisors, you know, out there. But that did give me a small advantage because you're not kind of make the same mistakes. So you get to move ahead a little bit faster and do some of the stuff. That's what got me into with the Grayback. I got into, we were cutting brush and we were doing invasive removals or, you know, trees, anything over or up to 6-inch DBH or diameter breast height. Mm-hmm. We would cut down and then pile and then later that winter we would burn them. And they wanted to keep like some of the larger, more established trees like Doug firs and, you know, some of the native trees. Mm-hmm. And I was piling brush with, you know, a bunch of young kids and they said, hey, who's got experience running a saw? And I did not. I never ran a saw, you know, maybe once or twice as a kid, but never really did, you know, we cut firewood, but not much experience. And I raised my hand. I said, I have a lot of experience running a saw. they hadn't, you know, it's not like they were asking for references from anybody. They were just like, and so couldn't be that hard. It's just a saw. I see the sawyers are doing it. The sawyers got to work ahead a day ahead or 2 days ahead. And then they would get their work done and stop and rest. That's what mm-hmm. I thought.
You're like, I want to do that.
I don't want to be here with all these people.
Yeah.
So they said, okay. And they're like, here's a saw. And and they just explained the job. You know, it was probably a 2-minute training. And we did have some saw training. It's not you know, that was the basics. But I had some on-the-job training for about 2 or 3 minutes. And they're like, yep, here's what you do. And mm-hmm. which, incidentally, in the tree world, you don't usually cut above your head.
Yeah.
You know, you get in a better position to cut. But there you would take 40, 50-foot trees, and you would cut it as high as you could, and you would slash it. In that way, the pine tree would come down at an angle mm-hmm. and just drop straight in the ground and poke. So if you're in a dense forest and you're trying to cut a singular tree down, if you try to fall it, it's just going to hit up against another tree. So you want that thing to stand up. And then so you just keep cutting it down until it's there. So we had a lot of really cool methods that we could never use nowadays to get trees down. And then we would just cut them down, leave them in 6-foot sections and move on. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool for like the first hour. And if you've ever held something heavy mm-hmm. for like a long time, you know, guys in the military, you know, you look at guys in the military and you're like, oh, they get to carry that M4 around and get to hold it up and on the SWAT team, stuff like that. And it's similar kind of experience of hold that thing up for 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And then just keep holding it up. Yeah. It seems fun. And I realized after the first hour, my arms were no longer could hold the saw up.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. And then, you know, then you're cutting. And of course, it's called rocking your chain, which is you have a nice sharp chain and then you touch it with a rock.
Yeah.
And your world and your whole life just comes to a screeching halt, and you're like, this is awful. Now I have to work to get this to cut. And incidentally, I didn't know how to sharpen a chainsaw. I didn't know that was part of it. You know, maybe.
But you had years of experience.
Right. Yeah. Had I thought it through? They did give me 2 files, and that maybe should have clued me in that you're going to have to sharpen a chainsaw. So, needless to say, and so that was that first hour. What I didn't say was, I didn't know that we work for 16 hours a day cutting. Mm-hmm. And so it took me 2 weeks of pure misery before I could finally get strong enough to kind of keep up and do the work. Yeah, that was kind of my hard lesson of tree work.
So that was pre becoming a hotshot?
That's correct. That was, yes. And you can't just come,
you can't
normally
just jump in.
Yeah, normally you don't become a hotshot your first year.
Yeah.
You do have a path to go forward. You have to have certain certifications and time and experience because they're a type one So there's a type 2 and type 3. So if you're okay. in Indiana, like we were, my sisters, that's mm-hmm. a type 3 crew. You know, your basic
yeah.
crews that maybe don't have a lot of experience in certifications, and you're not going to put those on hot fires and steep hills.
Yeah, that's where all the guys that were working with me on the trail maintenance, they were all like working towards becoming hot shots, but yep. they were starting out and still right. young.
Which is a good way to start. You know, you kind of work your way through and build experience and then build your, you know, your mountain legs and your mentality. Mm-hmm. And it's physical part is one way, but it's the mentality that, of course, yeah. that they need to build into you that you're not going to just give up, you know, at some point. Type one is the hot shot. That's the Helitack crew. Mm-hmm. Tiffany, my wife, she was on a mm-hmm. Helitack crew out there as well. And then my brother-in-law was a hot shot for the Forest Service. Those are all type one crews. And type two crews are your general crews that go out on fires and maybe not quite as experienced or have mm-hmm. as many layers of certification throughout their 20-man teams or engine units, maybe two or three, four-man teams. And so that's where I was working at, was trying to get on a type one crew.
Okay. Those,
you get on really cool, hard fires and, mm-hmm. you know, out west, at least at that time, that was 2008 mm-hmm. when I went out there, 2008, 2009 season. It was still like you tried to get the hard assignments. Like that's what your crews looked up to. Like if you tried to get on a hotshot crew that was in a location and mm-hmm. their home base. was in a pretty steep and rugged area
mm-hmm.
because then you hiked and practiced in really steep and you know, terrain, which got you in better shape. You know, sometimes like maybe if you're in the Snake River or, you know, Idaho and some of the more flat lands, especially if you go a little more towards Colorado-ish area, mm-hmm. some areas are, you know, they still have the hotshot crews that are in more flat land.
Yeah.
So it's a little harder to get that good exercise and hike in and stuff. And,
yeah. So you traveled quite a bit. It wasn't like you were hotshot cruiser stationed to like one
That's
location.
Correct. I think there's 100 to 150 crews
mm-hmm.
Between the BLM and Forest Service. And they all have this meet the same standards. And they're usually assigned to a base, but they're interagency. So they're
yeah.
you go to national anywhere. So we went okay. to California, mm-hmm. Alaska, you know, all over the Midwest,
oh, wow.
Idaho, Montana, Washington, and places. So okay. it was quite an experience, yeah. So yes, I was working my way that way.
Yeah.
We'll brief this up. I'm sorry I'm taking so long to tell you. Worked for Grayback Forestry, and we did some fire in there, so we got some fire experience, and I was a sawyer for them. That's kind of a big deal when you're on a fire crew. The sawyer is kind of your, you know, your elite crew. So I thought, oh, yeah, I want to be on a sawyer and saw crew. Because you're the guy that goes up ahead. You got more autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of do what you want. The other time you're in the back with mm-hmm. a Pulaski, which is an axe and
yeah.
little digging tool, and you get to swing that on the hard dirt ground and be yelled at, you know, the whole time because you're not digging fast enough, which was warranted because I wasn't. And
yeah. Can you explain what you were doing to prevent fire from spreading by cutting, and what were the people doing with the Pulaski? Like, what was the point of what they were doing?
Yeah, a lot of times you'd go through and do a fire break. You know, if they decided, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do a fire break here. Especially for creeping fires
mm-hmm.
and you lay down trees and then follow up with a trail or, you know, you dig a fire line. Now, most of the time you're going to backburn that line to create some distance because just digging, you know, some vegetation out of, you mm-hmm. know, in the dirt out west, there's lots of dirt and leaves. You know,
yeah.
it's not like here where we got lots of grass and stuff, but, you know, you dig that line out and move the dirt away and then you would just then burn that line back.
Okay.
And they would do a controlled burn if they've got time.
Okay.
So that's kind of the digging fire line. A lot of times you're near the fire when you're doing that. Sometimes you're trying to just come in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting kind of system that they've got because you've got guys assigned that are always like checking weather. You're mm-hmm. constantly looking for changes in wind pattern, relative humidity, and all this stuff. So they've got these little old school tools.
Mm-hmm.
They get this little aluminum can out and they'll mm-hmm. dip the wick in the cotton wick in water and they will spin it around
mm-hmm.
around like this in this thermometer thing, and it's called spinning, you know, spinning the weather or whatever you're
yeah.
spinning and trying to always taking those measurements out there. They probably have something digital now, but
mm-hmm.
knowing the Forest Service, they're not paying for that.
So yes.
So that was the Grayback Forestry. Did that a season, and then I got an opportunity for work on a logging crew. My brother-in-law was a cutter for this logging company. Mm-hmm. And then the transportation crew, the logging crew that moved it, was a helicopter company, R&R Connor.
Okay.
So I applied with that. At the same time, that company was talking with the History Channel for season 2 of Axemen. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of showed up at the interview for both, you know, the job interview for that, and as well as the Axemen was also sitting in on the interviews. The executive producers and stuff were in there because they wanted to see who was maybe going to come in and look interesting.
Yeah.
You know,
this is the whole reason I have you on the show. We needed someone famous. You know?
That's right. And so here's a kid from Indiana, you know, that used to be a cop and decided to come out west and do this, and was like, we want him because he looks like he's going to be interesting. And hopefully we find some things to exploit, you know, out of him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got hired for that. And I was on the, basically, I was a hooker. I know you're like thinking that, but it's actually spelled H-O-O-K-E-R. Yeah, I think it's the same thing.
That's same.
I just realized that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're like, you're going to be hooking up the logs for the helicopter.
Yep.
And I would have to say, working for a helicopter logging crew, we did not climb the trees. All they did was drop these 12-foot endless, those loopy slings down in bundles of 12 or 15. And then you would work your way across the hill going down. And so they would drop you slings and you'd communicate. You had a radio and you'd communicate. Yeah. And so I was on a mountainside. Another hooker was on a mountainside and another one. So you worked in teams of three.
I used to watch Axemen like pretty regularly. And I know exactly what you're talking about and the scenes like in my head. So I really have to go back and be like, probably saw you on it.
Well,
I wouldn't have known you at that time. So
back then goatees were in and I was 30 years old and just old enough to, you know, actually have some facial hair. So I was like excited to have a goatee.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, I'm going to apologize to any of the listeners if they go back and see that and then you're like, what is with his goatee?
Yeah.
Just keep that.
Well, you have to tell. So what episode was it?
I think it was season 2, episode 3 is when I started on that because they kind of, I don't know what. That's
when
we started.
I definitely remember like seeing that. I didn't know it was called hooking, or that you were a hooker.
Yes. Yeah. What's interesting is I found out all kinds of things. Like you go to a different area and have different experiences. Yeah. I did not know that a helicopter up in the air, you know, 300 or 400 feet above you, he's got I think it's 150 foot long line. There's a big ball at the end or a big round thing with a hook. It's kind of a self-closing hook. And when it starts to snow, I'm sure all the engineering geeks out there would be like, yeah, that builds static electricity. Oh. I did not know that. And the joke is whenever when somebody new starts, they don't tell them.
Oh, no.
So I'm it's snowing, you know, for the first time I go to hook up a couple log sets.
Yeah.
I've got a full bladder, you know, I'm working because it's still cold yet. I haven't worked all, you know, dehydrated yet. And I go to grab and get near the hook and about 2 feet away, a blue spark. And I remember thinking, what's that light coming from? And about that time I got shocked with, you know, I think it was about 30 kilowatts of electricity. I'm not sure. It could have run two houses for at least 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Or got tased. I've been tased a couple times and it felt similar to that.
Oh, man.
Anybody that gets tased is very angry.
All the while, the rest of the crew is sitting there laughing.
Oh, they're just dying. Yeah. Yeah. The pilot up there is watching and he's just, you know, laughing. And so I learned that. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, I'd like to pull it back into. So I assume after that you went back to being a hotshot?
Yeah. The logging season, wintertime and cold weather, and those contracts we had where we were doing beetle kill on a lot of the trees. And so that we were trying to harvest a lot of those trees for the Forest Service to repurpose those. They would get contracts for that. But then that next season, you have to start pretty early. And so I had applied for the hot shots.
Okay.
You know, I was on my second year. At that point, I had previous some fire and cutting experience and you were eligible to do that. So I had interviews with probably 10 or 15 different crews. And I got to pick, I had acceptance letters from all of them and got to pick the one I chose, which was Idaho City Hotshots. From everybody I talked to, they're like, yep, they're the most roughest and hardcore crew. And they're in super, you know, we were in Idaho City, which is right outside Boise. And it was certainly met my expectations of being difficult. Unfortunately, Tiff and I got the swine flu. I was supposed to go in on Sunday. I got the swine flu on Friday, and her and I had the swine flu, and I had to go show up my first day, you know,
sick
as a dog, throwing up. And if you know anything about the swine flu, the word, just the way it's described will tell you everything you need to know about it. We will save our viewers the description, but I showed up and was in bed for a week, and then it went to my lungs. And so it took me about 3 weeks before I could finally start getting better. And I was still hiking and trying to keep up with them, but I was always the last kid in the back. And they thought for sure they hired the worst, you know, employee ever.
Which in reality, you were toughing through an illness. Yeah. So you're but, quite the opposite.
Right. But, you know, it's not the kind of place where you complain or whine about how bad you feel. So you stick it out, and, you know, it just took a little time, a little longer to prove I was worthy to him. So.
Yeah. Obviously, it's a pretty extreme job, pretty dangerous job. Are there any moments that really just stick out?
Like the difficulty of the job, I would say. I guess
any close calls just made you question your career path?
Yeah, I'll start with this story. You know, a lot of people might not get this opportunity, and it'll probably make your heart pound once I tell you it. So we were camped out, and, you know, out there you don't have tents. You just got a sleeping bag and a bivy sack, and a bivy sack's a waterproof Gore-Tex that you can pull over. And so we're all camped out there. It was one of my first nights or whatever, and I went to get up, and one of the other guys are like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "I'm going to go use the restroom." And they're like, "You're not allowed to." And I was like, "What?" And they're like, "No, you don't get up until, you know, the crew, you know, supervisor gets up." And I was like, "What time is that?" And he's like, 6 a.m. I was like, "What?" He threw me a Gatorade bottle, and he's like, "Don't ever get up." And I was like, "What have I signed up for?"
Yeah. Why couldn't you get up?
It was just crew rules.
Okay.
Once you went down, you did not leave that group. You stuck with the group. You didn't wander off.
Was it just to be protection from fire, or was it from wolves?
I think it was just standards that they kept. You know, it was a discipline that team had.
Okay.
And you stuck to it. You know?
Okay.
And unfortunately, I am what you might call as undisciplined as they can be. But many people that have been in the Army or in those situations, you do become part of it, or your life becomes very miserable.
So yeah,
that I would call that a close call. But
yeah,
as far as some fire close calls, we've got some, you know, some fire retardant dropped near us and that missed us pretty close. And it's not the fire retardant that hurts; it's all the debris that comes down in the trees that comes flying at you from quite a ways. Oh, an interesting story I'll tell you is what I experienced was. So we were out there, and they've got these, what they call snags. So out in California, big redwoods, you know, everywhere. And we're working for the Mendocino Redwood Company at the time, which was owned by Gap Old Navy and, you know, that family that owns all of that. And so we were working, trying to save some of the redwoods in there. And there was this really large redwood tree that was 200 and some feet tall, but it was burnt out, and they called a snag. It was not safe enough for us to drop and cut. So they call in what they call AD guys. Usually they're loggers. So a lot of times loggers will work for the Forest Service because all they do is cut all day long. And so that some of them are really, really good. And so they brought these guys in, and they said, "Oh, we can't do it. We suggest we just, you know, bomb this, or, you know, put some explosives around the base and blow it up," which was pretty exciting because I've never seen a tree blow up. So they have us hike back, you know, 10,000 miles away, but we could kind of still see it. And we're all sitting there with the crew. And, you know, me, I'm a funny guy, of course. So which has not always been worked well for me. This time it did work out well. And so we're sitting there watching it, and they put the explosives up, and they call on the radio, and they're like, "Okay, everybody needs to face, you know, the tree." And everybody turn around and face it. So that's the protocol, is when they detonate something, you're facing it. And a lot of the guys on the crew were like, "Why?" Because they were like thinking you should look away so your eyes don't get splinters or blasted out or something. Not that you're even close to it. And so I took the opportunity to say, "Well, that's because if there's an explosion, there's a percussion of air. And if it hits, you know, it could go in your butt and cause an embolism," because I was a paramedic for the crew.
Yeah.
So I was maybe exploiting that knowledge and, yeah. and their lack of knowledge. And I was like, it could go, you know, and then rush inside your butt and then call it, cause an air embolism, causing you to stroke and die.
Uh-huh.
And
did anyone believe you?
Yeah, they believed me. Yes, they thought it was true. And
yeah.
I let it go for a while, but then
yeah.
I
and then you just like, told them?
Yeah. It didn't go over well. I thought they would laugh.
Yeah.
Nobody laughed.
It seems like everybody would want to watch it. You'd have to, like, if you didn't want them to tell them to turn away, right?
Yeah. The science behind it is you're watching for any trees or anything that's going to come after.
Yeah.
Which makes
yeah.
sense.
Well, you obviously moved away from, you know, that career. Is there any, like, smells or anything that brings you, like, back to a moment?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime I smell that burnt campfire, you know, smoke yeah,
something
that runs through there.
Is relaxing to most people and it brings you back to
you know, yes, it reminds me of the times that we were working in those and you're mm-hmm. in it. And I thought many times, I'm like, you know, my life is being shorted right now by breathing this in.
Yeah. That's and a lot of smoke to take in.
It is. It isn't something that
yeah.
nobody, the Forest Service does not want to really
yeah.
go on and deal with or anybody talk about. Probably yeah. like the coal miners. I'm sure for a long time we don't want to talk about that. But
yeah.
that is an issue. But although I know a lot of old smoke jumpers and a lot of old hotshot guys that are 80s and 90s.
Do people stay within that career for a long time, or is it usually a pretty short stint for most people who are hotshots or smoke jumpers?
I would say the majority, it's probably a short stint.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your summers are all, you're gone for 6-7 months out of the year, maybe
okay,
eight months. A lot of young kids do it. That's
yeah.
out west. That's kind of the rite of passage, and you do mm-hmm. it. But about the time that you're in relationships, it becomes a little bit difficult because
yeah.
you're constantly in that long-term, you know, gone for the summer type thing. So as you're young and having kids,
mm-hmm.
you kind of, in the Forest Service, I will say that they've got career paths that pull you out of that. They
yeah.
are very good okay. about identifying people that want to stay in the industry, and they've got some great schools and great training programs to get mm-hmm. people in positions that, you know, you start out in fire, and then you've got plenty of lateral movement that you
yeah.
can go.
Did you start with any of the career paths that they have offered out there, or did you just move back and
no,
kind of
I was
go on
I was
own?
On my way to be a, you know, be a smoke jumper, and
okay.
it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
But I could add that to the list of all the other things I wanted to do, you know, stuntman, Coast Guard rescue swimmer, you know.
Yeah, but it obviously sparked your passion for tree work and tree care.
Yes. Yeah. I remember when I said I was a sawyer for the Grayback Forestry crew.
Yep.
On the Hotshot crew, I swaggered up to the saw test day thinking they're going to make me a sawyer because I was I was a sawyer on the other crew. And they said, you're not good enough, and hand me a Pulaski.
So, okay. So back to square one. Yeah.
I was all the way back in the back. And in a matter of fact, that actually was extremely good for me because sometimes if you get everything you want, all of a sudden you become, well, hope you just become an asshole. So
yeah. So is there anything you took from that time out there or just being a hotshot in general that you feel like has helped make you the person you are today?
I know that it helped me with communication,
mm-hmm.
team organization, working with large teams. I really enjoyed, and working at a really fast pace. You know, with logging and hotshot crew, you had to do a lot in a short amount of time,
mm-hmm.
and that I really enjoyed that pace of the work and that team environment. So I know when I'm sure that I brought that back. You know, to any business that I'm in is, you know, I set a mm-hmm. tempo and a pace that's probably a little faster than some of the other ones.
Awesome. Well, thank you. And anything you took away from being a famous movie star?
yes.
Yeah.
Nothing is real on reality. Like, it's all set up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every, like, they're all friends. They all,
yeah.
everyone is, and it's all staged.
Okay.
Pretty much whatever you see is not real.
Yeah.
It's all staged and fabricated and made for the viewer to think that there's drama
yeah.
going on. And I hate to say it, but, you know, when people are just trying to do good work, it doesn't look like there's drama there. It looks more seamless and looks
yeah,
like an orchestrated play.
Yeah, I usually started fading on reality shows when it became a little too dramatic. I was like, a lot of people, I do believe, just watch it to, like, learn about an industry.
Well, it's like, you know, Belly Rings for Men. You know, it was popular. We had to go through that.
But yeah.
Glad that I didn't have that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was the 90s. It was alternative, and we thought it was cool. And I was like, I'm on the forefront of coolness.
I can't
and
stand.
Until you don't.
Yeah. Like, I do not like my belly button touch. There's no way ever that I would do that. We always wanted to do dirty jobs with Micro because we do like one of the nastiest jobs that I've done was like pond cleanings, like decorative, like koi ponds. And they're pretty nasty at times. And we're like, this would be perfect. Didn't really want to.
I would say that TV, cleaning a koi pond is essentially like cleaning a septic tank. Because that's what it is.
It can be.
I mean, it's not like the fishes go to the bathroom somewhere else, right?
Well, like or you're... like your client accidentally over chlorinates the water and then all the fish die over the winter when he did that. And then they all just laid in there and like decomposed slowly. And so you have all these half rotted skeletal remains of fish and frogs, and it's the only like lots of dry heaving.
Those are those memories that we all get to keep in our brains, and then you get to share them. And
I would say every time I smell that smell, I think of that. But thankfully, I haven't smelled that smell since.
Well, now I know what to put underneath your desk.
Yeah, dead rotting frogs. Well, Jared, thank you for sharing today. That was a fun story.
All right.
Have a good day.
Let's do it again.
Yeah, let's do it. There's something powerful about hearing how someone goes from fighting wildfire on steep western slopes to advocating for proper pruning and long-term tree health in our own community. It's a reminder that experience shapes stewardship. Jared's time as a hotshot in logging, and even under the lights of reality TV, all feeds into the work he does now. Caring for trees with knowledge, respect, and a bigger picture understanding of the forest. Thanks for spending time with us today. Thanks for listening to Acorn to Oak. If you enjoyed today's story or learned something new, join us next time as we keep growing tree knowledge from acorn to oak.